The Vermont Conversation with David Goodman is brought to you by Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility and by Stowe Cider, Green Mountain Power, Concept 2, Let's Grow Kids, The Alchemist Brewery, and by UVM Medical Center, Burlington, Vermont, as well as nearly 700 business members of Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility, who believe that sustainable business practices value people, planet, and profit. Welcome back to the Vermont Conversation. I'm David Goodman. We're spending the hour this week talking about educational justice and the movements that are arising around the country to push back against schools that are having their budgets cut, that are having police do carry out routine school discipline, and schools that are being privatized. Here to talk about this in our second half hour is Mark Warren. He is a professor of public policy and public affairs at UMass Boston, and the co-author, with me, of a new book, Lift Us Up, Don't Push Us Out, Voices from the Front Lines of the Educational Justice Movement. And we're also joined by Roberta Udo, who's a pre-kindergarten teacher in the Boston Public Schools and an activist in the Boston Teachers Union. Mark Warren, I want to kind of orient us to some headlines today. Secretary of Education Betsy DeVos has now called for using federal education money to arm teachers, arm schools, and to add more police to the schools. What's your response to that?
Well, I think it's a bad idea. It's the wrong idea, and it's going in the wrong direction. I think that there's been this movement that we talk about in Lift Us Up, Don't Push Us Out, against the school-to-prison pipeline, and it really has won victories all over the country to start to push back against zero-tolerance discipline. In fact, I would say right now that zero-tolerance is no longer the way of the land, that school districts across the country know that they have to look for alternatives, and this is really a result of the grassroots movement that's occurred. And so we have things like restorative justice or positive behavioral intervention supports, other approaches to dealing with issues of behavior that don't punish and discipline our children but try to get at the root causes of them. Now, we end up with a situation like the shooting in Parkland, which is really tragic, and in response, that provides an opening, I think, to people who really want to return to the zero-tolerance policies. You know, the reality is that these mass school shootings really predominantly occur in white communities outside of cities, yet the kind of increase in armed presence of police in schools is going to be incurring in our low-income communities and our urban communities. You know, so that our black and brown children are paying the price for harsh discipline on them when, you know, it's being billed as a response to the kinds of violence that are occurring in very different kinds of communities. So I think that I can speak for many of the folks in the book who are saying we want less police in schools, not more police in schools, that arming our police and our teachers is not the answer to violence. The answer to violence, when it does exist, is through restorative justice programs and also a massive investment in our low-income communities so that young people have not just quality schooling, but good jobs and safe communities.
You describe one scene in the book about traveling to Norfolk, Virginia, where you were working with a family. Just tell the story of what you encountered there. I thought it captured so much of the problem.
Sure. So as I was saying before, I do travel around the country, and I'm studying and working with many community organizing groups and parent groups, particularly in African American and Latino communities. So I went down to Virginia to work with a group called I Vote For Me, outside of Richmond, actually, and it was a suburban community. And as you may know, a lot of our suburban communities that used to be predominantly white are now host to large proportions of children of color. And so I was supposed to meet with the advocates for that organization the next morning, and they called me at 11 o'clock at night and said, oh, we can't meet with you because we just got a call from an African-American parent. And her son, her African-American son who's in middle school, he's on an IEP, an individualized education plan, and that plan allows him to go out onto the school grounds if he feels he needs to cool off for a few minutes. So he did that day, and a security guard came out after him and handcuffed him and dragged him through the ground, through the mud, and then he was sent home. And when he got home, all his clothes were just full of mud down through his underwear. And the parent called the school, and they said, well, he's not suspended. Just keep him home for a few days. And so this is the kind of thing where, well, he's not officially suspended anywhere, but he's actually been assaulted and then kept home out of school. So the mother asked to come in the next morning to meet with the school officials with her advocates, and I was asked to come along to observe. And as horrific as the violence against this child was, what was just as horrific was this kind of wall of school officials in front of this poor mother. And they refused to apologize. They agreed that dragging the boy through the mud was probably not right, but there was no apology, and no action was going to be taken. And at one point, one of the deputy superintendents got up and said, well, we have to end the meeting now because some of us have to go to work, which is a very condescending, insulting thing to say to the black mother, who, in fact, had taken time off from her job to go because she had to go and try to support her son in schools. So these are the kinds of things that I think both the violence that's happening against so many children of color, and then the sort of verbal brutality or bullying that happens towards so many parents when they try to stand up to this kind of behavior that's happening around the country. And this is what I think, the focus of the book is, we start off with these kinds of problems and really oppressive systems, but then we talk about what people are doing to organize against them and change them.
And say a little bit about the solutions that you see, some of the things that people are writing about, and we'll get Roberta's input on this as well in a sec, but I just want to follow up on your thought there. What are some solutions around the country that you think have been particularly innovative?
Well, I think there's a number of them. I think that in this school-to-prison pipeline and school discipline area, we have, first of all, policy changes to ban, for example, suspensions from pre-K to third grade that's been passing across the country. There's no reason that any child that young should be suspended. There has to be alternatives. And then, or to ban suspensions for something called willful defiance. This is a very subjective category that could be anything from wearing your hat or disagreeing, as Denise was talking about. She was suspended for willful defiance when she asked questions and stood up to some of the things that she was hearing from some of her teachers. And then the alternatives to these are things like restorative justice, for example, which I think when done in a really authentic way, which really engages teachers and students and families, when it's done that way, it's really an attempt to change the whole culture of the way the school operates, to really build respectful, humane, and relationships between teachers and their students and teachers and their families. So we're not looking just for a policy change. We're looking for deep transformative changes in the way that people relate to each other in schools. So that's one big area. I think another big area is sustainable community schools. And this has been something that organizing groups in New York City and many places have really pushed for. And this is the idea that to really educate children who are coming from poor communities, we have to really find ways to bring greater resources into schools to deal with the holistic needs of children. So sustainable community schools have nurses on site, they have mental health counselors on site, but they also have very strong forms of family and community engagement. Many have what they call parent universities on site that offer educational classes to parents that they get to decide about what they want or need. The reality is that a lot of our children coming into schools are homeless, right? Or their parents are working so many jobs because the pay is so low at each of these jobs. Or they're facing violence in their communities. And our schools have to find ways to address all of these needs. And so this requires greater resources. And so that's another thing that I think has been happening across the country. Sometimes people call it justice reinvestment. Or there are slogans, counselors, not cops. We want to move resources away from our criminal justice system and into our schools and into our communities So we're not just building community schools, but we're actually building affordable housing. So we're not just dealing with the trauma in a school of a child who's homeless. We're actually creating housing so that child is homeless, not homeless anymore.
You're listening to the Vermont Conversation. I'm David Goodman, and we're spending the hour this week talking about educational justice with the authors and contributors to a new book, Lift Us Up, Don't Push Us Out. Roberta Udo, you're a pre-K teacher. A lot is being said about, you know, the kind of trauma that children are routinely coming to school, and these things are unaddressed. What do you see in your students, and what is helpful in, you know, aiding them when their lives outside of school may be, very tumultuous?
I mean, it's really complex because certainly in Boston, there are not enough resources for the classroom teacher. So to expect a classroom teacher to resolve issues is not realistic. So, I mean, I think all you can do, and once again, it depends on the experience of the teacher, it depends on their level of cultural competency, how they see the child, their relationship with the families, and also, are they connected to organizations or activism outside the classroom and outside the school building that they understand what is happening to this child. And I think a lot of teaching is really done in a silo. Teachers are very kind of isolated from what's necessarily happening in the child's community or home. So there needs to be more outside resources that a classroom teacher can call upon, whether they're experienced or not. And those are not there for so many teachers. Those resources aren't there. So if you do have a child, a student with trauma, I mean, I can speak from personal experience. It can take a year for a child who's been identified as having trauma to get counseling. So that child is in your classroom for a year dealing with trauma, and you are also dealing with it, and so is the rest of the class. So, you know, because there are not enough counselors, not enough social workers, there definitely is not enough nurses to support what is happening in the world of that child and their family. And it's this lack of investment that is really killing a lot of the aspirations of not just students, but families and teachers. You know, you have your lesson plan, and you really want to, you want to teach this aspect to a child, and you can't because the child is going through so much that they need supports that aren't necessarily readily available to them or to you as a teacher. And I think the frustrating aspect, I think, for a lot of progressive activists, teachers, and unions is there really is no there's no progressive vision for public education in this country. It limps along. It's been limping along for years. And the vision now that is being offered is one of punishment and control, and so or worse. And so until we have this discussion about what public education should look like in this country, we're just all kind of out there doing whatever we can to get through the day. That's students, families, and teachers.
Let's turn now to Carlos Rojas. He is Director of Special Projects at Youth On Board. Carlos, welcome to the Vermont Conversation.
Thank you for having me.
You write a story about the experience of being an undocumented student and what you saw going on around you to other students who were living in fear and what was going on for you. Tell us a little bit about your own experience and how it's led you to activism.
Sure. What the perspective that I bring to this particular chapter of the book is really about connecting the dots between what it is like to be an undocumented immigrant or immigrant period in this country today and what it's like to be a young person, particularly a young person in an urban public school setting. And growing up in the neighborhoods of Boston between Roxbury, Dorchester, and East Boston, I saw a lot of fear around my community, which was largely immigrant and also largely black and brown. Saw a lot of fear of police enforcement, being targeted by the police. I mentioned in the book that I grew up in an apartment building of several dozen apartments where there was a cop knocking at someone's door almost every day or several times a week. And growing up in that environment as an undocumented person was really scary, and it taught me many things, one of which was to shut up and behave. And I brought that lesson with me to school. But as I grew older in the public school system in Boston, I watched what happened to my peers who hadn't learned that lesson, or who, because of what they were going through, the lack of support they were getting in school, in the community, at home, were acting out in the classroom. I saw exactly what happened to them, which was not at all different than what I saw happen to neighbors. Suspensions, expulsions, being arrested, being put in jail, dropping out of school. And that was really heartbreaking to me. And so it was really liberating to find, you know, in the book I talk a lot about finding Youth On Board, a nonprofit that's been around since 94, working to put young people, bringing young people from the margins to the center of decisions that impact our lives. And when I found Youth On Board and I was finally able to make, to connect the dots between what happens to immigrants like me and what happens to other young people of color, and how really it's all feeding the same carceral system in the United States, detention center for immigrants, prisons for black and brown primarily people and primarily men, it was really liberating. And I was finally able to sort of clearly see what was happening. And that information empowered me to be able to take bolder action because I knew why things were happening to me and my peers.
You describe a scene where you are speaking in front of students. It was the student walkout in Boston, where that Denise Wernham explained a little earlier. And you said in front of this crowd that you were undocumented and unafraid. What did that mean to you? And how did you have the courage to say that publicly?
You know, growing up as an immigrant without status at the time was probably the single most influential factor in my life beyond anything else. And if you know undocumented immigrants or immigrants, period, what you'll know, despite the propaganda machine, is that immigrants are hard workers. Immigrants behave well, pay their taxes, send their children to school, take care of their families well, and also, by and large, stay quiet and follow the rules, because it's dangerous in this country to not, as an immigrant. And I come from a legacy of the immigrant youth movement, the Dreamers, who courageously fought for the Dream Act in 2010. They were the reason why back then President Obama passed deferred action for childhood arrivals, known as DACA, in 2012. The reason why that all of that happened was because undocumented youth and immigrant youth decided to step out of the shadows and declare that they were undocumented. In other words, we put a face to what people largely just sort of thought of as this amorphous blob of immigrants without status. We demonstrated that we were your children's friends. We went to your schools. We live in your neighborhoods. We are friends with you. We mow your lawns. We deliver your newspapers. And that, I think, was it's sort of what broke the ice and what allowed what is now, I think, a flourishing immigrant rights movement that's really fighting for immigrant justice. So being able to step out of the shadows in front of this crowd on live TV back in high school was at once the scariest, one of the scariest things I've done, and also one of the best things that I've been able to do. And I hope to just inspire other young people who have similar stories to me as long as they feel supported, to be able to tell other people their stories.
How are you feeling today with the immigrant crackdowns that President Trump is calling for? And how do people who you know, other undocumented people, feel?
You know, as I was saying that, the piece about coming out of the shadows and being empowered by that, I'm reminded that not even months after President Trump was elected, there were several prominent immigrant rights activists who stepped onto a rally stage, declared who they were, and then were followed by ICE back home and arrested and put into deportation proceedings. So I think we're dealing with a completely different political climate today. There's a lot more fear, rightful fear, and people will do what they have to do to survive, whether it's hide, stay in the shadows, try to live their lives without, rustling feathers. And I think that is completely and totally valid. And so the last thing I want to do is encourage anyone to boldly step out of the shadows if it doesn't make sense for them. That, to me, is a really important thing, that people's stories are valid and your experiences are valid whether or not you come out of the shadows. But I will say this, particularly for Vermont, I think this is the time for allies to immigrants to step up, allies to people of color to step up. There is unprecedented racism that has floated to the surface in the current political climate. It's always existed, but it's bubbling to the surface in a way that we haven't seen in a while because of who is sitting in the White House and because of the climate. And I think this is the time for allies to immigrants, people who consider themselves friends to immigrants and people of color, to really step up and voice their concern about what's happening in our country.
All right. Well, Carlos Rojas, I want to thank you for joining us on the Vermont Conversation.
Thank you so much for having me.
And that does it for this week's Vermont Conversation. We have been spending the hour talking with a variety of people involved in the educational justice movement. Mark Warren is a public policy professor at UMass Boston, the author, co-author with me of a new book called Lift Us Up, Don't Push Us Out, Voices from the Front Lines of the Educational Justice Movement. We also heard from Roberta Udo, a pre-K teacher in Boston, and Denise Wernham, a student activist. That does it for this week's Vermont Conversation. You can hear this and all shows at vermontconversation.com. And tune in next Wednesday at 1 for another Vermont Conversation. I'm David Goodman. Thanks for listening. The Vermont Conversation with David Goodman. This special feature from Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility is underwritten in part by Concept 2, designers and manufacturers of Concept 2 rowing oars, indoor rower, ski erg, and bike erg, and proud to support nonprofit groups such as Salvation Farms, which nourishes Vermont by distributing produce farmers can't sell. Let's Grow Kids, a statewide campaign about the need for more high-quality, affordable childcare in Vermont to better support our children, families, community, and economy. Green Mountain Power, delivering clean, cost-effective, and highly reliable power to customers and offering cutting-edge products and services to reduce costs and carbon. The Alchemist Brewery of Waterbury and Stowe, a proud B Corp using the power of business to support a clean environment and economic opportunity for all. UVM Medical Center, Burlington, Vermont, the heart and science of medicine. And by Stowe Cider, with crisp, clean, and creative award-winning flavors. Visit the tasting room in Stowe or buy Stowe Cider throughout New England, upstate New York, and Washington, D.C., as well as nearly 700 business members of Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility, who believe that sustainable business practices value people, planet, and